House Committee on Judiciary, Wednesday, May 22nd. Full committee, work session. House bills to be considered are 2359, 2361, 2649, 2285, 2468, 2256. Senate Bill 573, House Bills 2332, 2873.
We've got a pretty full agenda, so I want to try to move through it promptly. And then we've got some subcommittee work also. I generally tend to take them in the order in which they're listed. We may deviate from that slightly to deal with a couple of scheduling matters where members have to be excused to go down and to find some other bills. Before we do, however, we need to recognize Lieutenant Hill to speak to an issue as relates to the prison bonding measure, which we previously sent down to Ways and Means Committee. The form in which we sent it down to Ways and Means, Representative Hill and his staff have researched and found that it's probably appropriate to recommend amendments to deal with a possible constitutional situation in terms of appointment authority and the relationship between the different branches of government in terms of serving on statutory commissions or committees. And Representative Hill, I think, would like to speak to us and get a consensus of support for his amendment and a letter from the committee to that effect. Representative Hill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'll be very brief. In the appointing authority, as House Bill 2982 was passed out, it stated that one of the members of the corrections facility authority would be appointed by the Speaker and one member appointed by the President of the Senate, and we wanted to avoid any type of separation of powers problem. So what we want to do is amend the bill to say that the Speaker shall submit a list of three people from which the Governor will choose, and then the President of the Senate will do likewise, and that removes the separation of powers problem and puts that appointing authority directly to the Governor. And because of it being a legal issue, I wanted a letter from the committee to that effect to go down to Ways and Means where the bill could be amended, and that's the essence of it.
Okay, thank you, Representative Hill. Representative Hill, would you like to make a motion that the committee adopt that position and work with you in the preparation of a letter, and then when that's prepared, we can ask for all of us to sign it. Would that be agreeable to you?
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Hill, so moves. Is there further discussion? Is there any objection to that motion? If not, the council will be instructed to work with Representative Hill to draft that and prepare for signature for all members of the committee.
Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chairman, and thank the committee.
Thank you, Representative. 2359, Council.
Mr. Chairperson, this bill deals with instruments that convey real property titles, which contain warnings as to zoning uses. In your subcommittee, there was discussion about the consumer protection needs. There were some amendments that proposed by Gene Grant of the Oregon State Bar Real Estate Section. All the parties agreed to them. There was 2359-1. The subcommittee adopted these amendments and has a due pass recommendation to the full committee.
Okay. Are there any questions about House Bill 2359 or the amendments adopted in subcommittee to the bill? If not, we take a motion. Representative Gunn.
Chairman, I would move House Bill 2359 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Gunn moves House Bill 2359 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Belden?
Aye.
Dunn?
Aye.
Burton?
Aye.
Dunn?
Aye.
Miller?
No.
Peterson?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
Sawyer?
Aye. Motion's adopted. I'll carry this bill. Next bill? I don't get to carry anything out of state and feds. So this, no chance. 2361.
I'm sure if we voted differently on a couple of issues, we could arrange.
Well, I certainly hope so too.
I don't even think if you voted differently.
We've got more minority reports than bills at this point coming out.
House Bill 2361 had several subcommittee hearings. This bill deals with real property that is sold under a land sales contract. This goes to the enforcement of the default and how to cure a default of forfeiture. There are several subcommittee meetings, as I mentioned. There were amendments adopted in the subcommittees. Two sets were from the Oregon State Bar, and they both were adopted. They're 2361-1 and a section on page 2, line 21 of the original bill. You have in front of you a handed gross version of the bill adopted by the subcommittee entitled LC 2361-2, and these have been clarified by the Oregon State Bar by Mr. Eugene Grant.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bellamy.
No, we've amended it, right?
Correct.
So I would move House Bill 2361 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bellamy moves House Bill 2361 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Bellamy.
Aye.
Dunn.
Aye.
Burton.
Aye.
Bell.
Aye.
Aye.
Peterson.
Aye.
Schultz.
Aye.
Aye. Motion's adopted. Any volunteers? Representative Bellamy, would you like the honors?
I'll try.
Okay.
Pepsi gets the next one, though.
It's a deal.
All right.
Okay, 26 for the time. probably a long list of people who want to help out the bar on their bills.
Oh yeah. Mr. Chair?
No, no, I'm in this
Are we on 2649?
I'm going to ask counsel just to review it briefly and then we'll be ready for motions.
Mr. Chairperson, this bill deals with foreclosure on trustee notice to people entitled to notice on foreclosure. There are several points that were not clarified, and we received from the Oregon State Bar a revised revised draft of their bill. You have in front of you a set of amendments 2649-6. I apologize for not engrossing them. I received them about 20 minutes ago. Representative Phillips, Hill and Miller have the draft as it was sent down to legislative council last week. So everybody has seen what the bill will look like if it goes out of the committee tonight.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, and these amendments were adopted by the subcommittee?
They were, but there were some word changes made, so we may have to re-adopt them.
Okay, Representative Bellamy, I think a motion on the amendments in LC form would be appropriate before the motion on the bill.
You're assuming I'm going to make that motion.
If that's...
I would move we amend House Bill 2649 with the amendments labeled 2649-6.
Thank you. Representative Bellamy moves amendments prepared by Legislative Council, House Bill 2649, entitled LC Draft 2649-6 and bearing today's date. Is there further discussion on the motion on the amendments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bellamy.
I need to ask a technical question. I received a letter from Norm Webb, who is a real estate attorney here in town. He indicated that the bill deals with the relationship of the trustee, that the trustee can be the attorney, and I'd like to know that section of the bill that we're dealing with. The trustee can be the attorney that actually handled the sale, and the trustee is supposed to be a third party that is neutral. The only question I would have, I'd like to see that language and where it specifies and talks about that. Particularly if that's amended in this bill.
Do I can talk to that?
Yes, if you can respond, go ahead, counsel.
In the original draft, trustee was defined and set in one way. At the original subcommittee hearing, we had representatives from the Oregon banks who wanted to include in-house counsel as trustees. Those amendments were accepted. They were 2649-2 and 2649-3. They should be in the definition section of the bill. We had extensive discussion as who was a trustee, and it was redefined, and it was found in your new set of amendments. Through several places, talking about the definition of trustee and the duties. So to answer your question, it's a little bit more than a disinterested party. It could be an in-house bank.
I guess the question would be, can one person do the whole thing?
I guess I understand the question.
Sell the property, develop the trustee, and actually be the trustee.
Ms. Trippers, we have somebody here from the state bar, real estate section. We probably better answer that question myself.
Okay, let's defer that question to the sponsors of the measure, if they can respond, or we do have a representative of the financial interest here. I don't know if they're prepared to respond today or not, but if we need some help on that question, we might defer it. Representative Bond?
Could I just comment briefly? It's appropriate under this act for the legal counsel for the particular entity transferring the property to be the trustee. There's not the normal conflict of interest situation in a trustee. Their name's on it, they're holding it in trust for the particular beneficiary. So they are allowed to do that. So if there's a bank, and a bank has in-house legal counsel, that in-house legal counsel can be the trustee on the deed. And it's not, that's not considered a conflict of interest in a trustee.
Is that sufficient, Representative Bellamy, or if you wish, we can put this to the end of the agenda in order to allow opportunity for further discussion or to have your answer, your question answered more fully.
No,
Well, we can carry this over to our next work session if you.
No, I think I'm comfortable. I think it's a small point. If it's a real problem is the way we develop the bill, I think we could address it on the Senate side. I normally don't like to do that. I just want to caution the committee that it appears to me that in my brief tenure in real estate license and studying this provision, we started out as a trustee being a neutral third party, slowly, gradually moving into the position where they're one and the same. And I think we're inevitably moving, and I don't know if it's good public policy where one person can do all three functions. And I think we're getting around that concept. But I will support this.
Okay, Representative Bunn?
To respond to that briefly, in a sense, the whole trustee process has some, in my mind, fictitious activities in it. In a mortgage situation, which is a first cousin to that, the mortgagee holds the interest directly. In a trust deed situation, you're one step removed, but I think it's only because of the technical historical development that has occurred. There's no real compelling need for that separate interest.
Maybe what Representative Bunn is talking about is something that has confused me and bothered me, is that maybe sometimes there needs to be a total look at that concept. Maybe it's antiquated in the whole trust, in terms of trustee.
You don't think so? Is that an attorney telling me to trust me?
You'd have a couple of heart attacks out here.
Well, I don't want to get rid of the trustee. Don't.
Your family's my suit.
I'm ready to vote.
Okay. Representative Phillips?
A couple of policy questions. When you went through this bill,
and discussed the notice procedures. I noticed you used 120 days in section 4. Moving through the bill for notice, there's the 10th day, the 30th day, the 20th day, the 25th day, all used at different sections of the bill. Some of it is existing law, some of it is new law. I guess I would focus on section 8 of the bill when it says a person did not have actual notice of the sale at least 25 days prior to the date, then goes on about their rights and proceedings and whatnot. Was there discussion in subcommittee about some why those days were picked, all different or varying? What does one have to prove? How does one prove they did not receive actual notice? What the process is there?
Just in the same bill.
Well, I believe so.
I don't think you're working off of hope. You should be working off of this.
I just asked Rocky that, and he told me to work off this one.
It's the same bill.
Section 9, referring to as far as 25 days.
So you're referring to Section 9?
Yeah. What you refer to as Section 8 is Section 9 of the amendments we have.
Okay. Well, the point was there's a variety of numbers and what it constitutes. How do you prove you didn't receive actual notice and what's that definition? Was there discussion or is there a reason to be concerned about those discrepancies? And some of it is existing law, and in this case, it's a new proposal.
Okay, well, I wasn't chair in that subcommittee. Representative Kopetsky is down in the Speaker's office. Council, can you try to respond? Or?
Mr. Chairperson, we really did not discuss days. We were told that days in there were reasonable and would provide adequate notice. There was no discussion of what would happen if somebody did not get notice. We would assume that the normal course, if a person didn't get notice, they would go to court and there would be a factual determination to see if he or she got actual notice.
Well, okay, again, the actual notice issue is what is actual notice? How does one prove it? I guess, and then the broader question is why are there at least 4 different dates for processing used? And some of these are accurate to what the lien laws require and other laws. We have 20-day notice, we have 15-day notice. In those bills, we amended it specifically to conform with other statutes that said 20 days, excluding holidays and weekends. I noticed in this, it was 25 days, and there was nothing, and there were other dates referred to. For the sake of consistency, was there a need to look at that aspect of the bill?
My recollection in terms of the days is the same as Mr. Gray's. We did not focus a lot of our discussion on that. In terms of the sliding scale for days and fees, I guess we, to be honest, we relied pretty heavily on the recommendations of the Bar Committee and others who'd worked on the amendments. I don't know if they have one of the drafters of the original bill here today or not. If we do, why don't we ask those folks to come up and respond if they would be so kind after identifying themselves for the record.
My name is Margaret Kirkpatrick, and I'm a representative today of the Real Estate and Land Use section of the Oregon Bar Association. The 25-day figure doesn't correspond with any other time period in the bill because it's not intended to accomplish the same thing as any of the other time periods in the bill. I believe the existing law requires a trustee to give junior lien holders 120 days notice of a trustee sale. The Section 8 of the bill that you're referring to, which I believe is Section 9 now, addresses everyone's rights when the trustee fails to give the notice to all the junior lien holders. This section was discussed extensively by the debtor-creditor section of the bar and both parties to the lawsuit that gave rise to the problem that this is intended to address. And everyone felt that if you put a 120-day notice in, you would essentially be requiring a re-notice of the trustee sale. That wasn't the intent. If you didn't put any time period in, there would be no opportunity for an omitted lien creditor to attempt to reinstate the trustee bill. So everybody seemed to think the 25 days was reasonable.
I guess I'm not criticizing why you picked the 25 days. The issue is, in statute, we have a whole series of different dates used. Some exclude holidays and weekends, some don't. At some point, I would think it would be cost-effective to make the statutes consistent throughout as to what are the requirements for time periods for all attorneys, whatever side of the issue they're on, filing a lien or defense, to get those dates known to all parties. And I guess I don't mean to pick on your bill here, but at some point we've got to start doing that. Instead of every time we amend a bill, we sort of pull things together and we sort of don't.
Representative Phillips, your point is a good one. You may or may not know that the Professional Liability Fund of the Oregon State Bar publishes a book that's about half an inch thick that lists different statutory time limits, everything from workers' comp, you name it. And it's a book about half an inch thick in terms of different notice requirements in statute for different kinds of proceedings, criminal and civil. Last session, or last interim, the Law Improvement Committee made an effort to try to look at those many deadlines. They didn't get very far, but one of their products was the original Senate Bill 91, which has been heard before this committee and which Mr. Kirk Hall, former counsel of this committee, testified about. That looked at a very narrow section trying to make more uniform statute of limitations for filing certain actions. I think that your point is well made. I think that the Law Improvement Committee probably intends to look at this subject again, but in terms of whether or not this bill ought to be held up
for that purpose. Well, I'm not suggesting that. I just want to know if there was any consideration to making some consistency. And I do have one other question.
Sure.
And I guess I've got to make sure I'm looking at the right bill. When you talk of, I've got it, Rocky, in this one on Section 8 regarding the 5 years of redemption issue, claim for action against the trustee for 5 years under the trustee sale, in Section 9 in this redeem within 5 years. Is that in the bill that we're acting on? I assume that it is.
Yes.
Okay, when you drafted that up, if I may ask a question.
Sure.
And you came up with that 5-year period. What was the impetus to that 5 years? Is that consistent with other statutes, be it workers' comp or whatever?
Statutes of limitation are all over the map. I mean, some of them are 2 years, some of them are 10 years. It depends on the cause of action that you're talking about. So there really isn't any magic number for determining what a statute of limitation on a given claim should be. Again, in this situation, it was just felt by all of the people who were involved in drafting the bill that 5 years was an appropriate life for this kind of claim.
Good thing, Phillips.
It's a little bit like picking a number out of the air.
I realize that. What I'm hoping to hear you say, however, is you pick the number out of the air that is somewhat consistent with other numbers as far as statute limitations that apply to remedies that are similar.
Well, typically a contractual statute of limitations is 6 years. That's a typical statute, I believe, it's 6 years on a contractual claim.
If that's the case, then why was 5 years picked?
Because there were certain people involved in the negotiations of this bill who wanted to see it be a little bit shorter. It was a negotiated compromise.
That.
I personally would have no problem with making it 6.
I don't want to do that.
It's 10.
I was just wondering why. It goes along with the theory of the time limits and having things consistent with the penalties or actions to be taken. And I'm just, I'm noticing it after the session has been winding along, that there's a definite inconsistency in some of the bills that we see before us as far as time limits. That's just a statement. I'm not
point well taken.
You throw the bill away for that reason.
Further discussion, Representative Burton?
In all of that, I wasn't certain that I heard a response to the other part of Representative Phillips' question, which was, to me, significant also, and that was how does a person determine whether or not notice has actually been given?
Oh, all right. There will be a hearing or some kind of a fact-finding, whether it be a trial or a preliminary hearing on a motion to dismiss. where the person who was entitled to notice could either testify in person that they did not receive actual notice and that would be treated like testimony on any other factual issue, or if the question came up in the context of the trustee's motion to dismiss the case, then the omitted lien holder could establish lack of actual notice through an affidavit. It would depend on when it came up.
That's important.
I guess I'm curious as to how the lien holder gets notice to come to the hearing.
Well, the lien holder,
or the question of actual notice
wouldn't come up unless the omitted lien holder had filed a lawsuit against the trustee for failure to get notice. So the omitted lien holder's knowledge doesn't become an issue under this legislation until the omitted lien holder has filed a lawsuit against the trustee as a plaintiff. Once the omitted lien holder has filed a lawsuit against the trustee as a plaintiff, they will be aware of the trial date or hearing dates on motions like any other plaintiff in any other lawsuit. The trustee's actual knowledge is an affirmative defense to their lawsuit under this statute.
I guess what I'm missing is that how does a person who's been omitted in the first place become knowledgeable to the point that they can even make, they could go ahead and go with the rest of the process?
It could come up in any number of contexts. There's no answer to that. Once they've been omitted as a lien holder, they either find out, I mean, it could be word of mouth, it could be through their bank, it could be any number of ways. I mean, I don't have a pat answer to that because
Okay, so in other words, if they discover through the bank in some way, for instance, that they've been omitted in a lien, then they can take action.
They can file a lawsuit against the trustee
at that point.
Failed to notify them. That's right.
And on the basis that they were failed to notify. That's what we're addressing in Section 8 here.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I assume, before I recognize Representative Phillips, just so we're clear on this point, that whenever there's a transfer involved or we're talking about this kind of process, that there's a fairly thorough title search, and to the extent that the title company can produce or identify the liens that exist, they're going to do so.
Right. There would always be a title search, and or there should. Any trustee that knows what they're doing, like
the title search prior to foreclosure. Now, we are aware that there are some liens that don't appear on those searches, but Representative Phillips?
If you run a title search and you're lucky enough to identify all the liens, if you are a trustee, how would you normally notify those lien holders?
There's a whole statutory section that sets forth the notice requirements.
Okay, I'm aware that you mail them.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be worthwhile to require certified or registered mail rather than just mail? These notices
I'm
must
actually
be?
Not sure what the statutory requirement is right now. I don't have a statute on mail. I don't know whether it is a certified
mail. I think the statute only refers to registered mail, if I recall correctly.
Mail?
Registered mail. There may be some. I'm not even sure it does that. It goes that far. But there may be some reason. Because the initial problem is, how do they get noticed?
Personal service.
Personal?
No. It's a fair question, and
that was not something that we addressed in this bill.
Well, you know, I don't know if significant. There is a problem in this whole notice procedure. We talk about lien holder's rights, what the trustee's responsibility is, what the timelines are, and they should be consistent. And if we're talking about actual notice and proof of actual notice, then there should be some corresponding proof of the attempt to notice. And the only way to do that I'm aware of, other than process server or some process like that, would be a registered mail or certified mail, or requiring it to be sent registered or certified. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I guess I might have to turn that around and say that Representative Phillips, I don't know of an institution that would not protect their rights by sending something certified mail.
Probably right. I wouldn't disagree with that. That was my answer to Representative Shipwreck when he came up and asked me, how does someone do this? And I said, if anybody had any smarts, they'd do a certified or registered or not to do the postal service.
Because I don't know how they would defend themselves in court that they provided notice if they did not do it to through certified mail, and the court always has more leniency for the person who is being foreclosed on.
Okay, well, I don't want
to... Richard Phillips, I don't want to jam this through because I think there are some good questions raised, and if a couple more days of research, we're not in so big a hurry that we have to act today.
Well,
there are some legitimate questions.
Okay, I think I can answer the question if what Rocky handed me is what the original bill here. In Section 3 requires... Is that right, Rocky?
Yeah, we deleted that Section 3, I believe, in the amendments. But Section 3 deals with notice under sale and advertisement, I believe, and it tells the various ways of getting notice.
Mailed by both first class and certified mail with the return receipt request at the last known address.
This is the original.
Burton on another point?
Well, while they're doing that, I was wondering, theoretical situation, what if it's a